cut out for that. I wasn't. I overstayed my time as a stay-at-home mom for like 3 years. I should have gone back to work as soon as Elijah was off the boob. But if you're happy doing it, don't even listen to me. It's okay, I said. You're probably right. Oh, shit. Elijah just woke up. I think he's starting a new round of puking up there. I'm telling you, if I have to wash one more load of vomit-stained sheets, I'm gonna lose my mind. She hung up before I had a chance to say goodbye. The thing I wasn't able to explain to Beth or Mark was why the idea of going back to teaching filled me with such fear. I'd never told anyone about Caitlin. I'd been an English teacher for 5 years before I became pregnant. I taught 4 classes, 2 sections of freshman English, a senior course in world literature, and a junior honors elective in creative writing. The winter I was pregnant, I gave my creative writing students a memoir assignment. Each student had chosen a memoir to read, and then they had to write their own. This was the type of writing that was most enjoyable to read. With 25 kids per class, I hardly got to know the students at all. The memoirs were an opportunity to see them in a deeper and more multidimensional light. They were due the week before Christmas vacation. Once I began grading a section of papers, I'd usually knock the whole stack out at once, and so the students were used to getting assignments back within a week. Since I'd become pregnant, however, I'd lost my usual stamina. I no longer had the energy to stay up till 11 at night after a full day's work. By the time I got home from school, it was all I could do to pull on pajamas and eat the dinner Mark had cooked before collapsing into bed. Thus, a week after turning the memoirs in, as we were getting ready to go into the Christmas break, the papers were still sitting in a yellow folder in my school bag. The Friday before vacation was a half day. Students dropped into my classroom between exams to bring Christmas cookies and boxes of chocolate. I was 6 months pregnant, hungry all of the time, and I'd been attacking a tin of sugar cookies when Caitlin came to see me.
Hey, Miss Weaver.
Caitlin stood hesitantly in the doorway. She was a slight, dark-haired girl who didn't speak up in class often, but usually had something valuable to say when she did. Though the desks were set up in a horseshoe, most of the time, Caitlin still managed to appear as if she were sitting in a back row, folding her body in on itself so that she was nearly removed from the semicircle. When I'd see her in the hallway, she typically had on headphones. She was the type of student I usually sought out, though this year I'd made fewer connections with my students, perhaps because I knew that in a couple of months, after the twins were born, I would be gone indefinitely. I wiped the crumbs from my mouth and swallowed the mouthful of sugar cookie with an embarrassed laugh. "Hi, Caitlin. Come on in." She hovered at the door for a moment before entering.
"I was just wondering if you'd graded our memoirs yet."
Bringing a finger to her mouth, she chewed vigorously on the already ragged nail. There was an ugly, pocked sore on the back of the hand she held to her mouth.
"No, I'm sorry. I haven't gotten to them yet. I'll get yours back to you after break." "Oh, okay."
She looked disappointed. "Would you like a cookie? A piece of chocolate?" I gestured to the bound on my desk.
No thanks."
Caitlin stood by the desk, eyes darting anxiously around the room. "Are you ready for break?" She shrugged.
"Yeah, I guess."
"Do you have any plans for the vacation?" She shrugged again.
"Not really. Just hang out, I guess. My parents want to go skiing."
"That should be fun." Caitlin nodded but continued to stand by my desk. "Is everything okay? Anything on your mind?" For a moment, she looked as if she might say something. There was a split second where I recognized the girl's desire to connect, but just as quickly, it was replaced by the detached and indifferent facade she'd developed during her years of adolescence.
"Nope, Just wondering about the grades.
She gave a half-smile and met my eyes for the first time since she'd come into the class. She began to back out of the classroom, but when she got to the door, she paused.
When are the babies due?
My hand automatically came to rest on my stomach. March 10th. She nodded and was quiet for a moment.
You'll be a good mom, she said, finally.
She held my gaze for a moment before looking away.
Thank you.
I was surprised how grateful I was for the words.
I hope so.
She gave me a small smile.
Have a nice vacation, Ms. Weaver.
You too, Caitlin. Have fun skiing. She turned and was gone. I meant to pull Caitlin's memoir out right then, but another student came by and then I had an exam to proctor. We spent Christmas with Mark's mother and sister, and the folder was still unopened in my bag when the call came from my principal. On Christmas Day, Caitlin Underwood swallowed a bottle of pills and killed herself. The first thing I did after hanging up the phone was to pull out the yellow folder. My heart pounded in my chest, and I was crying as I flipped through the stack of papers until I came to Caitlin's. I read the title, and my stomach turned over. She'd written a collection of poems for the assignment. The first one was called Drowning. I began to read, my eyes traveling so quickly that words and snatches of phrases bounced off the page. Feel like I'm being pulled underwater. Stole an X-Acto knife from art class last week. Wrote my initials on my forearm. No one even noticed. Beads of blood rise like mercury. No one sees. Water in my nose and mouth. Eyes in the hallway pass over me, never seeing. The water keeps rising. Where's the life jacket? I think I'm going under. Wonder how much longer I can keep treading water. I felt the pit of my stomach rising up into my mouth, and I dropped the papers and ran for the bathroom. As I vomited into the bowl, all I could think about was my last conversation with Caitlin. You'll be a good mom, she'd told me, and I'd been so grateful for this small gift the girl had given me. The funeral was on the last Saturday of vacation. I sat in one of the back rows of pews in the overflowing church beside several of my co-workers. Even from that far back, I could see the bobbing head of Caitlin's mother as she cried into her hands. I sat through the funeral with my own hands clasped tightly across my belly, as if asking my unborn children to never subject me to such pain. I listened as Caitlin's family and friends described a quiet young woman who loved to read and write. The word suicide was never mentioned. Instead, they referred to how she was lost or gone. Drowned, I kept thinking. She was drowning, and now she had gone under. After the funeral, I didn't speak to the family or go to the house where people were gathering. Instead, I sat in my car and cried, rocking back and forth in the driver's seat, the girls slipping silently up and down inside me. I never told anyone about Caitlin's memoir. At my next doctor's appointment, I learned that I'd developed high blood pressure. The doctor put me on bed rest for the last 2 months of the pregnancy for fear of preterm labor. I was relieved not to have to go back to the classroom, not to have to be reminded of my last conversation with Caitlin, and not to have to wonder if every journaling exercise or creative writing assignment had the potential to unearth what it did in Caitlin. I thought about throwing the memoir out. Rightfully, it belonged with Caitlin's parents, but I couldn't bring myself to give it to them for fear of what they might say to me upon reading it. And it seemed cruel to show them evidence of their daughter's misery after it was too late. I considered burning the poems, getting rid of the proof of my oversight,
I couldn't bring myself to do that, either. It seemed important to keep them somehow, to remember Caitlin, this complex young woman that too few of us had tried hard enough with, or to remind myself of the absolute necessity of vigilance at all times. In the end, I put the folder on a shelf in the back of my closet. Sometimes I'd stumble across it when looking for a misplaced sweater, and I'd have to sit down for a few moments and take several deep breaths before I could return to whatever I was doing. Every time I thought about returning to work, Caitlin's face shimmered before me, and I was gripped by a paralyzing fear and shame. And so it was easier to stay where I was. Stagnant, yes. Stuck, maybe. But culpable to another mother? Never again. Talking to Mark now, sitting in Lottie's living room, I remembered Caitlin. She was the first secret between us, the first thing I'd withheld. I'd kept it from him as self-preservation, not realizing it would be the beginning of so much unspoken between us. "I'm sorry," I said, though I wasn't even sure what I was apologizing for. "I don't know when Lottie's getting out of the hospital. Even once she's released, she's going to need help. She'll be in a cast, and I'm not sure if she'll even be able to walk. It's not as if I can just leave them here." I lifted Mia from her seat, and she blew spit bubbles at me and smiled. "I'll probably be gone for at least a week, maybe more. You might want to call your mother and see if she can come help out with the girls. If there's any way you can cancel your trip to New York, I think you should."
"Okay," Mark said.
He sounded tired.
"Just call me when you know anything more."
"I will," I promised. As I hung up the phone, I extracted a lock of hair from Mia's tight grasp. She leaned against my chest, and I closed my eyes, resting my chin on her seal-like scalp. When Mia and I arrived at the hospital later that day, Whit was already there. He sat in a chair by Lottie's bed and watched her sleep. With her eyes closed and the bruises on her face, I had a moment of panic where I thought she was dead. And then I watched her chest rise, and I was able to breathe again. "Hi, Whit," I said softly, so that I wouldn't wake Lottie. He looked up, startled from the intimacy of the moment. As often happened, his eyes took several seconds to register that I was Francie, the other sister.
"Francie."
His voice was full of emotion as he stood up and came to me.
"How are you doing?"
I planted a kiss on Whit's cool and bristled cheek, and then let my eyes close for just a second as his broad shoulders and arms enveloped me. It felt good to be held, and I leaned my full weight into him.
"She's been asleep since I got here," he whispered.
Then, noticing the baby carrier at my feet, he looked down at Mia.
"Is this..."
He squatted on the floor beside her.
"Mia,"
I said. He didn't take his eyes off her. Mia yawned, her pink mouth stretching into an O. I'd seen Whit during my last visit. He came for dinner, and Lottie made a chicken curry. We stayed up late, drinking red wine. Lottie had placed tea candles all around the room, and we'd watched the shadows flicker off the walls.
"Lottie told me the two of you had a falling out," Whit said, his eyes still on the baby. "It's complicated, but we haven't spoken since last April."
Lottie had left dozens of messages for me in the first few weeks, sending texts that I deleted without reading. She stopped calling after that first month. I knew we would speak eventually. I couldn't ever cut her out of my life completely. It would have been like cutting off my own head and expecting to live. Even when I wanted to the most, I knew I couldn't live without her. Lottie opened her eyes, and for a moment, something like fear flickered in her face as her eyes darted back and forth between us.
But then her face relaxed and she gave a wry grin.
Hi, kids.
Hi, we said in unison. Whit and Lottie looked at each other. So many unspoken things hovered between them. I'll give you guys a few minutes. Mia and I will be outside. I reached for the baby carrier.
Leave her here, Lottie said. Whit, can you hold her?
Her face was clear of all manipulation, or maybe it was just masked beneath the injuries to her face. But I knew my sister. We both knew what she was doing. Whit knew her too, and he should have known better, but he reached for Mia. I reluctantly placed her in his arms. He looked awkward and unsure, and I wondered if he'd ever held a baby before. Lottie didn't seem to notice. She patted the empty spot on the bed and smiled up at Whit. I closed the door quietly behind me. Returning from seeing Lottie in the hospital, back at Lottie's house with Lottie's baby girl, I experienced a strange slipping feeling. I unpacked the groceries I'd bought, sliding them into Lottie's empty cupboards, and I had the unnerving sense that I was moving silently into Lottie's life, leaving my own body empty and unattended as I stepped into hers. I was reminded of the paper dolls we cut out of books when we were children, carefully maneuvering scissors around the page, clipping the legs of the doll, the ruffles on the skirt, the flip in its hair. At the end, I'd hold a doll in one hand, and in the piece of paper where the doll had just been, her perfect silhouette would stand empty. It was nearly 5:30 in Boston, and though Mark would not normally be home at this hour, I figured he would be tonight. I dialed his number.
"We're cooking dinner. We're having spaghetti. Right, girls?" Mark said after he picked up.
I heard murmurs of approval in the background, followed by the excited cries of, "Mommy!" I pictured Mark in our kitchen, the sleeves of his dress shirt rolled up, his tie loosened, and the top two buttons undone. The girls would be sitting at the kitchen counter, and Mark would be filling plastic cups with milk. He'd probably forget to cut the noodles, and Anna would get mad when he tried to shake Parmesan cheese on hers, and Autumn would have to remind him to cook a vegetable. For a moment, I missed the easy domesticity that normally enveloped us all. "I'm making spaghetti tonight, too," I told him, "for Whit." I carried Mia in one arm while holding the phone in my free hand. I walked around the kitchen, jostling her in a steady rhythm. "I saw him today at the hospital and invited him to dinner." Whit and Mark had never met. Lottie and I were good at compartmentalizing our relationships. "He and Lottie broke up."
"Oh, really?"
From the tone of his voice, I knew he was distracted. The girls chattered in the background, and Mark murmured back to them in acknowledgement. "About a year ago, about the time I stopped talking to her." My eyes welled up for what felt like the 100th time in just a few days. "She was all alone, Mark. She had no one."
"You had every reason to stop speaking with her. She endangered our children. She shouldn't even have a child of her own."
He spoke quietly so the girls wouldn't hear, but the anger was real.
"This baby, Mia, is she okay?"
"She's fine."
"Do you think your sister is capable of taking care of her?"
he asked. I finally had his full attention. "I think she really wants to be a good mother."
"I asked if you thought she was capable of taking care of her," he said.
"Well, not right now. That's why I'm here," I said, stalling.
"In general."
It took a while for me to answer. "Some days," I finally said.
"Francie."
Mark's voice was heavy.
"What about the other days?"
"What am I supposed to do? It's not as if I can take the baby away from her. Lottie's her mother. How could I do that to her?"
"How can we not?"
he asked. I heard the girls calling in the background. I've got to go, I said.
Francie, we need to talk about this.
I'll call you later. Give the girls a kiss for me, I said, and then hung up the phone. I thought about what Mark had said. Clearly, Lottie loved Mia. I knew that from just the few short interactions I'd seen. But I also knew that love wasn't enough. I wished I'd lived close enough that I could see them every day, pay attention to how Lottie handled the pressure of all the banal tasks that having children involved. But then I'd be right back where I started, taking care of Lottie all over again. Neither of us wanted that. I pushed Mark's words aside. There would be time to think about the future. Right now, I just needed to put one foot in front of the other and take care of what was in front of me. I put Mia down for a nap and pulled a load of laundry from the dryer, making my way down to Lottie's room with the basket. Lottie had tons of clothes, and she didn't shop at places like The Gap or any other store that issued thousands of the same skirt to women all over the country. Lottie shopped in boutiques and consignment stores, and each item looked unique and made just for her. I'd always envied her sense of style. I tended to gravitate toward jeans and wool sweaters and t-shirts, all in inoffensive, muted tones. As I pulled each beautiful and carefully chosen item from the basket, I wanted to wrap myself in Lottie's clothes like a second skin. I quickly stripped out of my jeans and sweater and slipped into a purple silk dress with beading at the collar that I found hanging in her closet. I took the dress off and replaced it with a pair of tight jeans and a sparkly tank top. I slipped out of the jeans and tank top and put on a long white sundress that tied at the shoulders with red silk ribbons. I never wore clothes like these, and there was something thrilling about seeing myself dressed not only as Lottie, but as a different version of myself. The house in Palo Alto where we grew up had an attic filled with trunks of Mother's old clothes. I never understood why she kept them. Some of the clothes were winter gear she hardly ever had a chance to wear. Most of them were from when she was younger, in another life that Lottie and I never knew. In most of my memories, I picture her wearing slim black slacks or linen skirts. But in the attic, there was a heavy black trunk filled with fancy clothes in rich textures and another box full of high heels, some with straps and rhinestones. Our mother would pull scarves and white-fringed shawls from boxes, draping them over us. Beautiful, she'd remark as Lottie stepped into a cream-colored silk dress with a long pink sash. You're gorgeous, darling, she'd say as I zipped up a purple pencil skirt and matched it with a ruffled button-down. Beautiful, lovely, Lottie and I remarked to each other as we tottered around the rickety attic floor in high-heeled sandals. Mother, will you put on our faces? One of us would eventually ask, borrowing her expression. She'd bring us into the bathroom and kneel before us, carefully applying blush and lipstick and eyeshadow from her own bag of expensive cosmetics. Our father hated it.
They're too young for all this, Catherine, he'd say, turning his frown from Lottie and me to our mother.
Oh, stop it, Leo, Mother would say, shushing him. Stop overreacting.
But the makeup, he protested. It's just too much on little girls.
Don't be silly. Little girls like makeup, she would say, pressing her cool fingers to his mouth. She'd kiss him tenderly until he blushed. And Lottie and I gazed in admiration through sticky mascaraed eyes, both at our parents' love and at our mother's subtle skills of manipulation. Still wearing Lottie's long white sundress, I peeled back the quilt and slid under the covers of her bed. Thoughts of my mother often left me tired and depleted. My bare legs were smooth against the cool, unused sheets. And I lay down, breathing in Lottie's distinctive scent. I tried to clear my mind, to stop the endless spiral of thoughts and find quiet. I imagined a white piece of paper, a clear blue sky. But as soon as my mind was blank, Lottie's face would appear. The thin lines of stitches, the battered cheek, the image of her helmetless head, the sour milk in the fridge, and the overflowing garbage in the kitchen. You can try to pretend she's okay, I thought, but you'll never convince yourself. Francie. The year we were 17, the months after our mother died, was a season suspended in time. It was after the worst thing we could imagine had happened, but before Lottie's own mind turned in on itself. We watched our father withdraw. He'd always been a quiet man, but he possessed a warm and naked love for the women in his life, made clear in the moments when he would wrap his arms around his wife's waist or squat down on the floor to be closer to me or Lottie. But after Mother's death, he became silent and absent, working even longer hours than usual, returning home too rumpled and exhausted to talk with us. Within 3 months, he'd sold the small arts and crafts home where we'd grown up. Lottie and I were too stunned by it all to even object. He moved us into a 3-bedroom condo closer to the university. It was the first time Lottie and I had our own rooms, but most nights we ended up squeezed into one of the twin beds together. Pretty soon we realized that if anyone was going to pick up the pieces of our home life, it would have to be us. In the first few weeks after Mother's death, the house was filled with casseroles and pasta salads, blueberry cobblers, lasagnas and quiches, the offerings brought over by neighbors and friends. Lottie had the sense to put them in the freezer, and we slowly made our way through the food in the weeks that followed. But once we moved, there were no longer neighbors to keep watch over us, and the cupboards remained empty. The toilet bowl took on a pale yellow tint and the acrid scent of urine. The kitchen counters were sticky and oily. The refrigerator was bare except for milk, butter, cheese, and a variety of condiments and sauces. In the closet were saltines, a loaf of bread, a can of oyster stock, and a jar of beets. How these items made their way from the old house to this one, we didn't know. But it became clear that our father had no plans to grocery shop, cook, or clean anytime soon. This had always been our mother's domain. Our father mowed the lawn and took out the trash, but she took on the daily management of the house herself. She cooked and cleaned and helped us with our homework, expecting little of our father other than his steady presence and good humor. I wondered if my father even knew how to operate the vacuum. One evening, he returned home with a greasy paper bag filled with burgers and fries from a diner in town. He'd been staying later at work, getting home just in dinner time with a rotation of takeout, pizza, Thai, Chinese, Indian. The pantry was filled with miniature packets of soy sauce and ketchup. That night, Lottie and I were waiting for him, already seated at the kitchen table. "Dad," Lottie began as he unpacked the burgers. He didn't even bother putting out plates, just poured the fries onto one of the wrappers in the center of the table and unceremoniously plopped a burger in front of each of us. "Daddy," Lottie tried again. "Eat up before it gets cold," he said, taking a bite of his own burger. Orange cheese hung from the soggy bun. "We've got to do something," Lottie said. "This house is a mess, and there's never any food." He didn't look up or answer, and I nibbled anxiously on a fry. "This isn't what she would have wanted. We need to do better than this." He looked at Lottie, really seeing her for the first time in a while. And something seemed to pass between them. Lottie held his gaze, but then he dropped his eyes back to his meal, his hand groping for his wallet. He withdrew several $20 bills and placed them on the table.
"Here, you and your sister can buy a few groceries tomorrow. Pick up some cleaning supplies, too. It's getting a bit untidy in here."
He ate several fries at once. We'll go now, Lottie said, standing up. She held her hand out for the keys. Mother had taught us how to drive the previous winter. They were terror-filled sessions with her, clinging anxiously to the armrest or door handle as she barked out orders, but the end result was that we'd each passed our driver's license test on the first try. Our father fished the keys out of his pocket and handed them to Lottie.
"Do you want to finish your dinner?" he asked.
Lottie sat back down reluctantly, ate several bites of her burger and a few fries, and then stood up again, waiting for me to finish. We drove to the Safeway, where we filled the cart with pasta, deli meats, cereal, and cans of soup, and then added bleach and toilet cleanser. Our father began to leave money underneath the sugar bowl on Friday mornings, and together, Lottie and I would do the shopping. We struggled home from the store laden with bags. As most of our friends were making plans for the weekend, we tackled the house, changing the sheets and doing laundry. Our father began to return home from work early enough that we could eat together in the kitchen. Quiet, simple dinners of pasta or soup and grilled cheese. By the time summer came around, we'd learned how to make the household run without our mother. And this knowledge filled me with both pride and the hollow understanding that we'd actually survive without her. The summer arrived without the usual excitement that typically accompanied the last few days of school. Lottie and I had gotten jobs in downtown Palo Alto, Lottie as a waitress at an upscale diner in town, while I would be working at the candy shop several stores down the street. The Apple Shack was a bustling restaurant that hired attractive college girls each summer. The uniform was a khaki miniskirt and pink polo shirt that the manager seemed to only buy in size small. Lottie was the youngest of the waitresses, though that didn't stop her from making friends with the older girls with an effortless agility. Sweetland was a far less glamorous establishment, and I worked with only two other people. Tanya, the baby-faced owner whose round hips and waist were evidence that she sampled too much of her product, and Kevin, a thin, gangly boy who'd just graduated from our high school. I could wear whatever I wanted to work, but once I arrived, I had to put on a bright red Sweetland apron and a white paper cap. Lottie and I both worked the evening shift. Most nights, I worked alone in the small sugar-scented shop, and I'd bring a book to read as I perched on the stool by the register. On Friday and Saturday evenings, Kevin would be there too, and those nights usually passed faster. Despite Kevin's somewhat goofy appearance, he was surprisingly loud and funny. He didn't seem to harbor any of the self-conscious embarrassment over his looks that I would have assumed. Lottie's shift didn't start till 5, and she'd often stop in on her way to work to say hello and buy a piece of butter crunch. Kevin, who had no problem chattering on endlessly, to me, always became tongue-tied and inarticulate around her. He'd find something to keep himself busy, sweeping the back room, lining up the chocolate turtles in perfect rows, wiping down the already clean counter. When she left, Kevin would come back to the register and prop himself on the stool, resuming his continuous stream of chatter as if we'd never been interrupted. That night, I asked him about it. "What's the deal? Why do you act so weird when my sister comes in here?"
"Dude, your sister's hot. I always get nervous around hot girls," Kevin answered.
I held my tongue. I didn't say, "We're identical twins, you moron." It was true the apron and paper hat gave me a lumpy, genderless look, especially when compared to Lottie's minuscule uniform. We were flat-chested and petite. We were pale, with unmanageably curly hair, and could be called either button-nosed or snub-nosed, depending on whether you were trying to be cruel or kind. Yet Lottie possessed a self-assurance that rendered her hot, while I was still just cute. Kevin was suddenly busying himself with the jelly bean display, and I realized Lottie had come back into the shop.
"Some of us are going to a party after work if you want to come," Some of the guys that my co-workers know from school.
Lottie nodded her head at Kevin.
You can come too if you want.
What time?
I asked. Well, we get off close to 11, around then.
Sweetland closed at 9. I was usually curled up in front of the television by 11.
Come on, Kevin urged,
suddenly more talkative now that his chance with Lottie was emerging.
Why not?
I don't know, I said. Parties made me uncomfortable. Lottie tended to go off on her own and leave me standing alone by the keg, unsure of whom to talk to.
I've got to get to work, Lottie said. If you change your mind, come by the restaurant.
She turned to leave, and Kevin reached out and squeezed the skin on my forearm. Hard.
Ow!
I yelped, turning to him. He was giving me an intense stare. Oh, fine, I grumbled under my breath.
We'll come, I called to Lottie. Kay, Lottie said, not even bothering to turn around.
Instead, she lifted up her hand and waved, waggling her fingers. Kevin gave me a thumbs-up sign, his knobby thumbs sticking foolishly in the air. I turned back to my book with a sigh. After work, we walked over to the Apple Shack. I watched Lottie and the effortless way she joked with the other waitresses, as if she'd known them her whole life and not just a few weeks. They were the type of girls who'd always intimidated me. Tall, tan, with an easy poise that came from years of dance classes and sporting events. California girls, though technically I, too, was a California girl. When Lottie got off work, we piled into the car of one of her co-workers. A few minutes later, we pulled up in front of a large brick house several blocks from the Stanford campus. Kevin and I followed Lottie, who was already marching up the front steps of the house as if she lived there. One of the girls carried a case of Heineken, passing out beers to everyone inside. The house was large and would have been beautiful if anyone other than college boys had been living in it. Instead, the living room was decorated with beer advertisements and glossy posters of bikini-clad women lounging on sports cars, and a giant pool table was set up off to the side of the room. There were couches, but they looked at least 50 years old, and in all likelihood, they were probably picked up off the side of the road for free, or passed down from tenant to tenant. The party was already in full swing, and as I had suspected, Lottie soon disappeared, leaving me with Kevin.
Cheers, Kevin said, clicking his bottle against mine.
Cheers. I took a swig, forcing myself not to make a face as the flavor hit. I didn't like beer, but I didn't drink very often, and Lottie said it was an acquired taste, like coffee. I didn't particularly like coffee either, and didn't really see the point of acquiring a taste for something you didn't like, especially if it wasn't good for you to begin with. But I drank the beer anyway.
Cool party, Kevin said, glancing around.
I nodded, drinking more, figuring if I drank faster, then maybe I would acquire a taste for it sooner. Kevin seemed to be looking for Lottie, and I was tempted to tell him to give up. It would never happen, but I kept my mouth shut.
So, what's it like being a twin?
I forced myself not to roll my eyes. People always asked us this. It's okay. Good, I guess. After 17 years, I had yet to come up with a pat answer.
It must be cool. Did you guys play tricks on your parents and stuff when you were kids?
We could sometimes trick my dad, but my mother always knew. Kevin suddenly looked serious.
She died this year, right?
I was surprised that he knew this. We weren't friends at school. I nodded.
I'm really sorry. That's gotta be awful.
I nodded again, finishing the beer in one long swallow.
Sorry. I didn't mean to...
He trailed off, and I held up my empty bottle. Someone had left the case of beer at our feet, and Kevin grinned as he opened another one and handed it to me.
I gotta take a leak, he said,
and suddenly I was left alone, always my biggest nightmare at a party like this. But somehow it didn't terrify me quite as much with the beer in my hand. The second one went down easily, and I was acquiring a taste for it. I didn't mind the dull tang anymore, and holding the cold bottle was like a prop. I didn't have to worry about what to do with my hands. Maybe I'd start smoking, too. I sank into one of the couches, trying not to think about how many people had probably spilled beer or vomited or had sex on it. The couch was soft and squishy, and I was tired. As predicted, Lottie was nowhere to be found. With the two beers taking the edge off my shyness, I observed the party as it unfolded. In one corner, a tall brunette was talking with a thick boy in a baseball cap. The brunette was fingering her beaded necklace as she talked to the boy. In another corner, a busty redhead with freckles was talking to two tall boys in khakis and plaid shirts. She fiddled with her hair while she talked, throwing her head back to laugh every few minutes. As I scanned the room, similar scenes were playing out all around me. If I went looking for Lottie, I'd most likely find her talking to some boy, twisting her bracelet or pulling on an earring, reaching out to touch his wrist every few minutes to make a point. It was as if all these girls spoke some secret language I'd never learned.
What's up?
I looked beside me on the couch, expecting Kevin, but instead, a boy in a maroon Stanford cap and pale blue Oxford was sitting beside me. He was handsome in a way that high school boys were not, and dark hair peeked out from underneath his hat.
Hi. I mean, nothing, I faltered.
You look bored,
he grinned at me.
No, not bored, just watching.
Watching what?
People watching, no one in particular.
Kind of like your own anthropological experiment?
I'd heard of anthropology, but couldn't remember if it was the study of stars or some other science, so I just nodded. The boy held out a hand.
I'm Jonas.
Francie.
His handshake was firm and solid. I suddenly wished, not for the first time, that I spoke that instinctive language of flirting. I brought a finger up to my hair in an attempt to play with it in the easy way I'd seen other girls do, but my ring ended up getting snagged on a curl.
These yours?
He asked, gesturing to the case at my feet.
I guess.
Can I have one?
I nodded, and Jonas reached in and pulled out two more beers, handing one to me. I realized my bottle was empty.
So, do you live on campus?
He asked.
We live in town.
Who's we?
Me and my sister.
I looked around, wondering where Lottie was now. I wanted her to see me with Jonas.
Where do you live?
Right here.
He nodded to the room. I told him my major was science, and he asked what type of science, which stumped me. I said biology, since that was the only science class in which I'd gotten an A. He told me about the advertising agency in San Francisco where he was interning. I caught sight of Kevin standing alone in the doorway watching me, though he didn't say anything. Jonas was asking me a question.
Sorry, what?
He laughed.
People watching?
Yeah.
My head was beginning to throb, and I wanted to lie down, but not here.
I asked if you wanted to go sit outside on the porch, Jonas said.
Okay, I guess,
I mumbled, getting to my feet. Someone had lowered the lights, and as I made my way through the living room and kitchen, I was aware of Jonas's hand resting on my back. Kevin stood awkwardly by the stairs, intently examining the label on his beer. Lottie was in the kitchen, talking to a shaggy-haired guy by the refrigerator. When I stumbled past, I nodded blearily, and she eyed me with concern, but didn't stop her conversation. The porch was actually a small back deck, set up with plastic lawn chairs and a wooden swing just big enough for two, an out-of-place piece of furniture in this setting. I was about to sit in a plastic deck chair, but Jonas caught my hand and pulled me onto the swing. He was a large boy with thick quads,
much bigger than the boys I knew from high school, and the chair was a tight squeeze. Jonas didn't seem to mind. He handed me another beer, which I accepted even though I didn't want it. This one was in a silver can, and it tasted stronger. Before I realized it, Jonas had brought his hand to my chin and was turning my face toward his, bringing his mouth close to mine. He smelled of beer and shaving cream, and his tongue was slippery, like a fish. I had kissed boys before, 4, to be precise, but none of them had moved with the ease that Jonas did. None of them had the hands of a man, and I felt a thrill of pleasure and fear zip down my spine. Even as we kissed, I was thinking about telling Lottie later when we got back home. But when I pictured telling her, I imagined us in our old house, in the room we once shared, our parents asleep down the hall despite the steady thump from the water heater. The idea of going back to the condo, into my own bedroom, filled me with a tired sadness. "My mother's dead," I said, between kisses. Jonas had managed to work his hand inside my bra. "I'm sorry," he breathed, his fingers working steadily against my nipple. I felt a rush of warmth shoot through my stomach and groin. "She fell down the stairs," I persisted. I suddenly wanted to talk. I wanted to tell him about Mother, about how beautiful she was on the nights that she dressed up to go to a fundraiser with our father, about the heavy scent of her face cream that she smeared on before bed, about the weeks when she wouldn't come out of her room. I suddenly wanted to tell him everything. "That sucks. I'm sorry," Jonas whispered, pulling my hand toward him and guiding it to the crotch of his jeans. I felt the hard warmth through the denim. I didn't know what he wanted me to do, so I just let my hand rest there, atop the bulge in his pants. Jonas let out a soft groan that made me wince slightly. There was something too primal about the noise. My bra was unclasped, and now he was trying to get my shirt off. Even through the dull haze of alcohol, I was aware enough to know that I didn't want to get undressed on the deck of a crowded house party. I held on to the hem of my t-shirt and shook my head. "Why not?" Jonas asked, still tugging gently on the shirt. "Too many people," I said.
"We could go upstairs to my room," he suggested.
I shook my head again.
"Okay."
Jonas resumed rubbing his thick fingers inside my shirt, and I let my hand rest where it was. He brought his free hand on top of mine, putting pressure on it so that the hardness was pressed firmly into my palm. He moved my hand back and forth in a steady rubbing motion and let out another groan, this one louder. I was aware of a wet warmth between my own legs, even as the sound of his noises filled me with a mild revulsion. He stopped playing with my breasts, all attention now focused on the bulge in his pants. At one point, he tried to undo the button and zipper of his jeans, but I shook my head again, murmuring, "No." This time, it was not so much out of modesty, but out of a fear at what I would see. Even in the dark, I knew I didn't want to see what I was holding. His breath came in short gasps, and I felt detached from my body. It wasn't me sitting here doing this. I was somewhere else, back in our old bedroom, Lottie tucked in across from me, Mother asleep down the hall. I rubbed faster, harder, somehow convincing myself that if I could do this one thing that other girls did all the time, easily, casually, without a second thought, if I could do this one thing, then when we left the party, Mother would be at home.
We would go back to our real life and everything would be okay. All I needed was to do this one thing right. He came with an abrupt groan and grunt and released my hand, leaving it motionless on the quickly deflating denim.
Fuck,
he whispered in a low breath, his head resting on the back of the wooden swing. With his eyes closed, I could see him more as the boy he was just a few years ago. A Marty Layton, or another popular guy at school. I felt a flash of pride and self-loathing roll together at once, a feeling that would only grow stronger over the next few days.
Fuck,
he whispered again, and then,
thanks.
He turned, his eyes focusing on me for the first time since we'd come outside. His arm fell casually around my shoulder, and I rested my head against his firm chest, breathing in the comforting smell of laundry detergent. I closed my eyes for a moment, wondering if I might just fall asleep right here.
I'm gonna get a beer, Jonas said,
straightening up so that I had to lift my head.
You want one?
No, thanks, I whispered. My mouth was dry.
Okay.
He walked into the house, the back door slamming behind him. Inside, the party was loud. The sounds of laughter and bottles clinking and jokes spilling out onto the deck. I sat on the swing, the hard wooden planks digging into the back of my legs. 5 minutes passed, then 10, then 15. I'd assumed he was going to come back after he got his beer. He'd asked if I wanted one. I wondered if he would have come back if I'd said yes. The beginning of tears pushed forward, but I squeezed them back. This was no reason for tears. Giving a hand job to a boy whose last name you didn't know was no reason to cry. Your mother dying? That was a reason to cry. Knowing you would never see her again? That was a reason to cry. Imagining her smashed and broken body amidst a heap of strewn clothes, that was a reason to cry. But not this. I sat on the swing, pushing myself back and forth slowly with one foot. After what must have been 20 minutes, I heard the door slam shut and the sound of footsteps making their way toward me. Francie? It was Lottie, not Jonas, and I was flooded with disappointment and relief. Are you okay? She settled beside me on the swing. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I let my head rest on her shoulder. Not really. What happened? She asked. But I didn't answer. What's wrong? Nothing. Everything. Lottie picked up my hand and squeezed it. I know, she sighed. I want to go home. Okay. We'll see if we can get a ride. She straightened up. No. I want to go home, Lottie. Our real home. Oh. She slid back onto the swing. I know. But we can't. We can't go home, Francie. It's too late for that. Soon we would go back to the party. We'd find Kevin, probably sitting alone somewhere, drinking his beer. We'd find the girls we came with, and maybe one of them would drive us home. More likely, we'd end up having to walk several miles back to town. We'd go into the sterile, silent condo where our father was asleep alone. And mother would still be dead. The tears did come then, heaving sobs, and Lottie held me tightly. She wrapped me in her arms and rocked back and forth as if I were a child and she was my mother. But it wasn't the same. Lottie. After Mia was born, I was good. For a while. Francie and Whit have never understood why I go off the medication. It's a hard thing to explain. An unfair thing to try to rationalize. as they were often the ones who were left to pick up the pieces of my shattered self and put me back together again. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty took a great fall. I felt like Humpty, an egg shattered into a thousand pieces, lovingly taped back together again, but still never quite right. After Francie left, after Wit left, after Mia was born, I realized how few friends I actually had. There were co-workers from the university who came by bearing casseroles and baby blankets, but no one I was particularly close to. I saw Wit a few times while I was pregnant, but after Mia came along, I stopped returning his calls. He had made his choice, and I didn't want to watch him judge me as I mothered. I couldn't stand to see him scrutinizing my moods, my appearance, waiting for some clue that I was unfit. It was easier to ignore him and pretend I'd never wanted to spend the rest of my life with him. The medication has tricked me so many times. Too many times have I thought that the handful of pills has cured me. As if I am swallowing a 2-week course of penicillin and not medications I'm expected to take forever. If pain has no memory, then my roller coaster ride through the black and white suffers from amnesia. While I have patchy memories of the despair, it is with detachment, as if I'm hearing someone else's story. It is nearly impossible to remember that I make it through the day because of the pills I take each morning. And so, when I don't take those pills one morning, I'm surprised how quickly the descent begins. On one particular morning, Mia sat in her bouncy chair by my feet as I drank my third cup of coffee. Trying to battle my exhaustion with coffee is like using an umbrella in a monsoon and thinking you could stay dry. The exhaustion rained down on me like a storm throughout the day, letting up for an hour here or there, and then returning in full force. I ran a brush through my hair, hurriedly put on lipstick, and reached for the first bottle of pills. There was never just one. It was always a combination. A cocktail, as the doctors called it. Bringing to mind images of brightly colored drinks with umbrellas sticking out. As I uncapped the bottle, I paused. Had I taken the pills the day before? I couldn't remember. And suddenly, the idea was there again. Maybe I didn't need them anymore. Even as the thought wound its way around my brain, I could feel the room begin to tilt. I had been so good. I had been on all of my medications since Francie left the previous April. Every night, after I tucked Mia into her crib, I prayed for the strength to continue taking the pills. When my mouth became dry from the dehydration the medication caused, when a prescription-induced headache would overpower me, or when insomnia would keep me awake night after night, I would pray to God, to Francie, or whoever might be listening, to give me the strength to keep taking my medicine. But I could be a better mother without all of the side effects of the pills, without the insomnia that descended unpredictably and unbidden, and that left me exhausted the next day, without the restless energy that left me unable to sit still for more than a few minutes, without the tremors in my hands that made me worry I would drop Mia. I would be a better mother without the pills. Liar, a ghost whispered in my ear, the heat of his words damp on my neck. I heard the harsh rasp of his breath as he reminded me of the black, the days to come when I would not be able to get out of bed. What kind of a life is that for a child? The ghost asked. Or the white. Those moments when I was caught in the grip of flight, so high up and away from everyone else that I was untouchable. What kind of a mother will you be on those days? The ghost was angry. We'd been here before. But this time, it would be different, I pleaded.
I would be different. I was different now. I was a mother. Mia had already changed me. Please, I begged him.